Hello and welcome to A Killer Podcast. My name is Freya Millard.
And I'm Amy Woodcock, and we are your hosts.
Hello everybody, welcome back to the historic crime season. Dun dun
dun. To episode 4. It is episode 4, right?
I think so. Yeah, that sounds right.
Like it is, that is the right number.
We'll make it episode 4.
It is now.
Yeah. And as always, it is Amy's turn.
It is.
You are the renowned episode 4 giver.
I am. We always do the same order. It has to be that way now. That's just how life is.
Yeah, we just want to keep it consistent.
And everyone has to accept it.
Don't fight us. You get what you get.
So at the end of last week, I gave the hint of this week's episode being serial killer.
Oh.
And we mentioned that it wasn't going to be Jack the Ripper because, you know, overrated and all that.
If I remember correctly, it was because you'd already solved the Jack the Ripper case. That's why.
Well, yeah, this is the thing, guys. I'm sorry to confess.
No.
That I have not solved Jack the Ripper.
Oh my God, Amy.
I'm sorry to let everyone down. I've let my family down.
Yep. Give that formal apology.
You know, I've just let the whole world down. And I do apologize, but I have not found his DNA yet. I haven't found his ancestral line, but you know, we'll keep on keeping on, guys.
You gotta do it, Amy.
Maybe one day.
You know, there's only so many people on this tiny island. Surely, Amy, just a few more weeks of you searching, you'll get there.
Yeah, just a couple more weeks. Maybe by episode 10, I'll have solved it.
That's a promise. You heard it here first, guys. Amy Woodcock has said she will solve the Jack the Ripper case by the end of season 10 of the historic crime season.
Yeah. Wow.
Season 10? Oh, wow. We're doing a lot of seasons. Episode 10. That does give you more time, though.
It does. And it also gives an incentive for people to stick around for the rest of the season to find out, you know, whether I have done or not. So
I might just legally go check whether we can get sued for false promises.
Disclaimer, I cannot actually solve the Jack the Ripper case, guys.
But if this is something you need to believe in and you want to believe in, then we're going to offer it to you because we love you.
But yeah, we're here for you guys, for this fantasy that, you know, I can definitely do this.
Yep, that's it. We're here to deliver the fantasy.
Exactly.
So now that we've cleared up that you have not and do not intend to solve the Jack the Ripper murder, well, murders.
Yeah.
What's your plan then, Amy? How are you going to impress us?
Just my incredible wit.
I don't know.
And charm.
Ooh, is that enough?
And my beautiful voice. I think that's enough.
Ooh, I think we'll take it to the polls. We'll see.
We'll see. We'll see what everyone has to say about that.
We'll see what the audience have to say.
And they have to say yes, else I'm quitting.
No. Threats.
No more episodes.
Oh my God. Absolutely not.
Right. Shall I probably start my story at some point today?
Yeah, you should tell us who is the serial killer that you are going to cover then, if not Jack the Ripper.
Jack the Ripper?
Jack the Ripper. I thought it sounded Old Englishy, so that's what I was going for.
Old Englishly, yeah.
Yeah.
Beautiful. So, my story today is about a guy called John George Haig? Haig or Haig? It's the only time I'm going to say it, so it's one of those. So do you know this one? Do you know this guy?
No. When you initially said it, it brought me back to, was it George Joseph Smith?
Oh, yeah. Was that the one you did?
Yeah, first episode of season 2.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought, oh.
Like, him again?
Oh, no, Amy. Oh, no. But it seems like a basic serial killer name, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
John Joseph.
George.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of those.
They all seem like they come up a lot when we start talking about serial killers.
Such a basic serial killer name.
Yeah. God, get some originality, guys.
Well, he is known by other names.
Oh.
So his sort of like serial killer name is the Acid Bath Murderer. Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, well, that sounds gruesome.
Doesn't he sound like a great time?
I think you might have spoiled the ending there.
Oh, no. There's no acid in here, I swear.
No.
Joking, there is.
Disclaimer, lots of acid involved.
Lots and lots. So yeah, what we have today is just your classic English serial killer from the early 1900s.
Mm. So same operating time as our buddy George Joseph Smith.
Yeah, exactly. I think maybe it was the times.
It was the times. Wow, we really do try to push that quote.
People are going to be like, shut up. We don't want to hear it anymore. Like, oh, okay.
Stop. No, no, don't say it. Don't say it. Don't say
not
it.
Not again.
Well, we love it, so we're going to keep using it.
So, yeah, we'll have to deal with it.
We'll do a poll on that one too and see if you guys still like it.
All the polls.
Yeah.
Right, so let's take you to the start of John's life. John was born on the 24th of July 1909 in Stamford, Lincolnshire, to his parents John Robert and Emily Haig/Haig. And they were both members of a conservative Protestant sect called the Plymouth Brethren, who were this like Puritist religious group who love the Bible and stuff.
sounds like a good summary.
Yeah, I love that. So John spent his childhood in a village called Outwood in the West Riding of Yorkshire, but he was later to claim that he suffered from reoccurring religious nightmares during his childhood, you know, with his very religious parents and all that. He said that his parents had built a 7-foot fence around the house and they wouldn't let him bring any school friends back in case he was contaminated by the outside world.
Aww.
Which does sound pretty nightmarish, to be fair.
Yeah, I feel for him there. That isn't a nice situation to be in.
Yeah.
But then how does it lead you to put people in acid baths?
Exactly. So, yeah, his, like, whole childhood, he was, you know, surrounded by this idea of evil is in the world and they had to be kept separate. And his only form of entertainment was Bible stories. Which I'm pretty sure Bible stories are pretty violent, I think. I don't know, I've never read the Bible.
Oh, you didn't get that sort of religious upbringing, Amy, where it was forced upon you?
No, I didn't.
Oh, you had to fill out the little worksheets, the Bible worksheets on the weekend.
Oh, cute.
And go to church. Oh, the nightmare.
Yeah, I didn't have that, so I don't know.
I'm getting the stress. I'm getting heart palpitations just thinking about it.
This is where you become John.
Honestly, me and John.
Too much in common.
Yeah. If I start tempting you into an acid bath later in life, Amy, just...
You'll be like, Amy, come look at my bathroom. I'll be like, no, I'm good.
Still no.
I'm going. Bye.
You got all the signs.
So he had, like, not a great childhood for himself, really. But he did well in school, and he ended up winning a scholarship to Queen Elizabeth Grammar School, and then also to Wakefield Cathedral School. Great times.
Yeah.
He became a choir boy, which I think is pretty classic for a religious family member, right? Be a choir boy.
Yeah, I didn't get to be a choir boy, unfortunately.
Aw.
I applied. They didn't take me.
That's just rude.
It was rough. The rejection really hit, you know. It's just something I struggle to talk about.
One step closer to that acid bath. So when he left school, he then became an apprentice to a firm of motor engineers. He only worked there for a year and decided to leave his job to take up a job in insurance and advertising. Just at the end of age 21, he was actually dismissed from this job for suspicion of stealing. So, whoopsie. Whoopsie, John.
That is not very Christian of you, John.
Ugh. It's not. It's shocking.
I'm sure that's somewhere in the Bible. Thy not steal from thy neighbour. Thy not jealous of thy neighbour.
/ job.
Yeah, something like that. It was on the Ten Commandments. Yeah. I don't know. I know it's somewhere.
Come on. You were the one who'd studied it. Come on.
You blank out trauma, Amy. You blank it out. It lives in a deep hole in my mind.
So then at the age of 25, John got married. He got married to a 23-year-old Beatrice Betty Hammer. And the couple actually lived with John's parents. But this relationship did not last long. As within the same year, John was jailed for fraud.
Oh, okay, John. Little career criminal.
I'm just building up my little rap sheet here.
Yeah. I was also going to say that it seemed very unlike the times that he was married so late. Like, he was married at 25 and then it didn't last.
Yeah, I know.
It was not the times.
Well, it's even more so is that when he was in jail, so his wife, Betty gave birth, but she actually gave the baby up for adoption.
Oh, wow.
And then she left John, so like they got divorced. So that's even more like against the times, you know.
Yeah.
Divorcing and giving away a baby back then.
Ooh, the scandal.
I know.
But you know what? You have to make decisions that suit you in life even back then.
Exactly.
She was caving the way for freedom. Don't be tied down. Don't get married. Don't have babies.
Don't do it. But you can definitely tell that it was against what his family believed in, because he was actually ostracized from his family after all this happened. When he got divorced, they were like, nah, this is step too far, John. Step too far. You can go to jail, but get divorced. Don't bloody think so. You're not part of this family anymore.
I kind of feel like his family are a bit dickish.
Yeah, not getting great vibes.
But also, can he do anything to stop the divorce?
I don't know.
It's not his choice, really.
Yeah, true. But then I wonder, would a woman even be able to do the divorce back then, or would it have had to been like he would have had to have been a part of it?
Mm.
I don't know how many rights we had.
Not many. No. Still not many.
Minuscule.
I think there was some grounds, but I don't think it was common, and it would have been very hard. You'd have to have some wealth behind you, a good family name, be white.
Yeah. That always helps.
Yeah.
So after 2 years in jail, John was released. So we're now in 1936. And he decided to move to London, where he became a chauffeur to a William McSwan, who was a wealthy owner of amusement arcades. And John also actually looked after and like maintained his amusement machines. But he decided he didn't want to stop his criminal ways. And he began to pretend to be a solicitor named William Cato Adamson. And he was saying that he had offices like all over England, so like London, Guildford, Hastings, Sussex, you know. He was just like, yeah, I'm a big shot solicitor.
Mm.
And he was going around and he started to sell fraudulent stock shares, allegedly from the estates of deceased clients. But obviously, you know, he didn't have any. Because, you know, he wasn't actually a solicitor.
Wow. That's what that other serial killer was doing, like the fraud and changing identities. It sounds like it was so easy just to reclaim an identity.
Yeah. They just love doing that shit. I think it was probably was easier back then because there wasn't so much like contact between places.
True.
That kind of thing.
And when you think about the last episode as well, where we were talking about Charlie and Gustav and how he changed his name to Charlie, like petitioned the court.
Oh yeah.
So it must have just been like really easy to just be like, this is who I am now.
This is me.
See, when people talk about, you know, how hard it is to get the rights now to change your name and change your identity and all that, but like clearly men were doing it for a long time. So
yeah, they were just, I am whoever I want to be. Thank you very much.
There's one guy just petitioning to be a missing child and he got that granted.
That's still wild.
There's all these serial killers getting their bloody second names.
Yeah.
That other serial killer was married to like five people. That was all granted with new identities. So
yeah, that's true.
Let it be.
So yeah, he started doing all these little scams and stuff, but that didn't last very long because it was uncovered very easily by someone noticed that he actually misspelled his own fake name on some letters. And I think they on one of them it also said that he also was misspelling like the places that he supposedly had offices in on these letters. So they were like, are you sure that's where you're from and who you are? Because you can't spell it.
That's the worst way to have your ploy uncovered, isn't it?
Honestly, he didn't do a great job there. So yeah, good old John ended up with another 4-year sentence for fraud. So that's what, jail time two? Yeah?
Yeah. And lost his job once before that as well for potentially stealing.
Yeah, for stealing. So he's just not very good at the crime. So he was then released just after the start of World War II. But nothing would stop John and his fraudster ways, and he would end up getting back in prison several times more.
All for fraud?
Yeah, every time, like, he just kept doing it. Every time he came out, he'd start doing it again, and then he'd get caught again, and then go back in. He wasn't very good at it.
Maybe it was, like, an addiction? Like, you know, when people gamble or whatever, to get that high.
Yeah, can't stop himself.
Yeah.
Just that love of money.
Yeah, could be.
During this time, when he was in and out of prison, he realised that his biggest downfall was that he was leaving victims to tell of his lies.
Oh, no.
So he was like, hey, maybe I should start getting rid of my victims. See where we're going?
Yeah, maybe you should just stop doing the bad thing you're doing, not do an even badder thing.
No, the thing to do is get rid of the victims. No. God damn it.
Okay, here comes the acid.
So this is when he became intrigued by a French murderer named Georges Alexandre Sarret, who would dispose of bodies using sulfuric acid.
Mm.
So from this, he was like, okay, I'm going to become a little scientist and do some experiments. So he got some field mice, he got some acid, which this takes me back to my uni days. And like, no, I didn't.
What were you doing?
I didn't melt people with acid, right? I didn't use acid in anyone.
This takes me back to the good old days where I would take my acid.
This takes me back.
And my mice, and I would
take my mice.
And I would go out and have some fun. Just me, the mice, and the acid.
Good old days.
Those were the days.
Not quite that, but I did actually use mice.
999, hello, yes, I'd like to report Amy.
She crazy.
Yeah, she's psycho.
But no, I did actually use mice in some of my experiments for post-mortem research. So I was like, oh yeah, mice and science.
Ooh.
But I mean, I did it for a good cause and he wasn't doing it for a good cause. So
I need to see this research to know whether it was really for a good cause. It's like research with air quotes around it. My research. What were you researching?
For ages, my phone was just full of like pictures of decomposing mice.
Jesus, Amy.
And I'd just be like swiping like, well, let's go past the folder of decomposing mice.
I think it's time to put forward another poll whether we ask whether Amy has any more secrets she needs to reveal on this podcast about her devious past.
You can all read it. It was my research project. You can all look at it if you want. I'll show you.
Don't look, guys. Don't look. This is how she lures you
it's
in.
It's very official.
She lures you in with a research and then you never come back out.
Want to see my research?
You don't want to be a folder on her phone. You don't want to be a folder.
Join them. Join them.
Oh, God. This is going to come back to haunt her.
Yeah, let's move on very swiftly.
Yeah, quickly, Amy.
So unlike me, John was very bad, right? I wasn't bad. John was bad. So
I had precision. I was so good at dissolving bodies.
I made a research report about it, so he didn't, you know.
He didn't have my research. My research.
So John had his mice and his acid. And he found that it would only take 30 minutes for a body of a mouse to dissolve. So he was like, okay, cool. He then used some calculations on this to decide how much acid and how much time it would take to do it to a human body.
That seems pretty good research. That's like quite thorough.
I mean, yeah, I was like quite impressed. I mean, he wasn't doing it for a good reason, but smart.
He's trying to like plan his MO before just going out and doing it. It's a smart way to learn, I guess.
Yeah, do some practice.
Again, who are we advising on this bloody podcast?
Always practice your murder before you do it.
Yep. Oh, oh my God. Christ. Oh, stop us.
Oh my Lord. Right, okay. So once John was finally like finished with his prison sentences for his fraud and he was out and about, he became an accountant with an engineering firm. And then soon after, he bumped into his former employer, William McSwan, if we remember the guy.
Yeah.
The rich guy with the amusement stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he bumped into him in a pub and was like, you're right, mate.
You want to go for a little bath? You wash down that pint and I'll wash down you.
You finish that and we go for a dip?
Oh, no.
So they started to like become quite friendly and William introduced John to his parents, Donald and Amy. We love an Amy.
Aw, that's so cute.
Yeah, so they're all like pals. And William actually worked for his parents as well. He helped them out by collecting rent because they owned property. And from all this like meetings up and hanging out, John started to get really envious of their lifestyle because they were quite well off. So he was like, damn, I want a bit of that.
Getting into that cycle again where he's like, need the high, need to go for it.
Yeah, exactly. So suddenly on the 6th of September, 1944, William McSwan disappeared. Oh no.
I mean, that was not how I thought he was going to do it, to be honest. So is he just going to be like, I'm your new son.
I am here now.
Hello, mummy. Hello, daddy. It is I.
Well, I mean, it's kind of where it goes, to be honest.
Is it? What? I really thought he was going to go for the parents.
Yeah, well, that's coming. Right.
Oh my God. I need to shut up. I'm spoiling it.
Don't jump ahead.
Sorry.
So, what happened to poor William? Let's start with William. Yeah. He was the first one to go.
Right. Please. So, backtrack.
John lured William into his basement. He was like, come down here. Have a look at this. Have a look at my research.
My research.
My research. Once he got him down there, he hit him over the head with a lead pipe and then put his body in a 40-gallon drum filled with concentrated sulfuric acid.
Mm.
So William got his bath.
Oh, poor William.
Nasty.
That is...
2 days later, John found that William's body had mostly dissolved, so he emptied the drum into a manhole.
Oh, that gave me lovely bones vibes.
Oh, that's, yeah. You don't want to be down there.
No.
So yeah, William disappeared, and John was like, went to William's parents and said, don't worry, your son's just gone into hiding in Scotland.
Okay.
Because apparently he was like, oh, he's avoiding being called up for military service. He's gone into hiding.
Oh.
And they were just like, okay.
That seems weird.
Yeah, I know.
Just believe this guy.
I know. Surely, like, he would have told his parents if he was going to do that.
Yeah, you'd think they'd be like, I'm just going to ring him.
Yeah.
He's in hiding from the military, not us. Like, I can talk to my son still.
Exactly. But no, they believed it. And so John took over William's position in their life. He moved into their house and he started collecting their rent for them. So he was basically William at this point for them.
I called it. I called it. So good.
Yeah.
So good.
But things started to crumble a little bit when the war came to an end and their sons did not return from hiding. And they were like, what's going on? Like, the war's over. He doesn't need to hide anymore.
Yeah. Where's my son?
What's he at?
Yeah, that's a hard one. How do you explain that?
He doesn't. That's what he does.
Okay. Couldn't come up with anything. He could have just been like, you know, he met someone, he's gotten married.
Yeah, exactly.
You just like, no, I've got to do something drastic.
Yeah. So on the 2nd of July, 1945, John decided to lure them to the same place that he lured William by telling them that he was back and that he was there and waiting for them.
Oh, that's actually so sad. They just went there thinking they were going to see their son who's been missing for years.
And now it's like, nope. And once they were there, he killed them with a blow to their head and dissolved them, just like he did to William.
It's like he really had a vendetta against that family just because they had some money.
Yeah, he's like, I want it all.
Mm.
Which actually, he started to take. So he began to steal all their like rent monies, their properties, their pension checks. He was like, it's all mine now.
That is ballsy.
Yeah.
Because people in their lives will start to look for them and you're going to be the guy that everyone knows goes and collects the rent, is doing everything on their behalf.
Yeah, who's like taken over all their properties and...
Yeah, you're going to be the first suspect. Absolute fool.
Yeah, I know. So he obviously started to get a bit of money at this point. So he moved into a fancy hotel in Kensington in London. But John was a gambler and by 1947, he'd started to run short of money.
I called this as well.
So, yeah, he does have an addictive personality, yeah.
It's like me and John, we know each other. Am I John reincarnated? Who knows?
Oh, God. I'm glad I don't have any money.
You watch yourself, Amy.
I'm never going to get rich.
You wait, you wait. I just think John is here with me. Maybe he's like whispering in my ear. He's like, yeah, and I did this next. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'll mention that, John.
I think he is. So, yeah, he started to run short of money. So to solve his financial troubles, he found another couple. This time it was Dr. Archibald Henderson and Mrs. Rose Henderson. So they were trying to sell a house. He was like, started to feign interest in the house, being like, oh yeah, I'm really interested in this property. And he ended up becoming like friends with them. Apparently that's how that worked back in the day. You know, you just became friends with anyone, I think.
It's so hard to do that nowadays.
I know.
Like, the amount of people I tried to meet to become potential victims and they just like dismiss you. 2 meter distance.
Ruined all your plans. Can't invite them to your house to look at your research.
Exactly, Amy. Oh, it's like, what? All the hardware down the drain, you know? Instead of the bodies.
Instead of the bodies.
Oh, it's terrible.
So he made friends, unlike you.
Yeah. You don't have to rub it in.
And he ended up getting invited to their flat to play the piano for a housewarming party. So I was just like, what?
Man of many talents.
He is. He could play the piano. So whilst he was at the flat, he actually stole Archibald's gun, which is never a good sign. He was just like, oh, I love that. For his next step, he decided to rent out a small workshop in Sussex and he moved his acid and his drums there. You know, nice little place to do his research.
Lovely. Sounds pleasant.
Yeah. And on the 12th of February 1948, he drove Archibald to his workshop saying that he wanted to show him his inventions, which is kind of like saying his research.
His research.
It is, kind of. His inventions.
That is absolutely, yeah. Maybe it's you and him that are really linked.
I think we're all linked. We were born on the same day, so we're all one.
Yeah, that is true.
We are all one. So when Archibald arrived, John shot him in the head with the gun that he stole from his house. And then once he'd done that, he also lured Rose, Archibald's wife, to the workshop, claiming that her husband had fallen ill. But when she got there, he shot her as well.
He is very good at luring people, isn't he?
He really is.
He must be very...
like a charming guy, I think.
Yeah.
So once he'd shot them, he then disposed of their bodies in the same way as the others. So he filled up these drums with acid and popped their bodies in there. Once he'd done this, he actually also forged a letter with their signature and sold all of their possessions for £8,000. The only things he didn't get rid of was their car and their dog, which he kept both.
Aww, he's got a soft spot for the dog. Yeah. Oh, I don't know why.
No, it's not what I was thinking.
Oh no, what were you thinking?
I was just thinking, like, why? Why, man?
Because dogs are the world, they're the purest, the most beautiful thing in the world. And even a serial killer knows that they do not deserve harm.
That is true.
I mean, neither do the people, but like dogs especially.
Freya is not condoning aciding people.
Not condoning. I'm just, no. I just would be...
Yeah, I get what you mean. I get what you mean.
I love dogs. I love them.
So John had obviously got the taste of this now, and he's like, oh yeah, I'm getting away with it. So he was like, I'm going to find myself another victim. John's next victim was Olive Durand Deacon. She was a 69-year-old wealthy widow of a war hero, and she actually lived in the same hotel that John was living in. So obviously it must have been some very fancy hotel.
And she has another fancy name.
Yeah, that is a very fancy name. I feel like double-barreled just always sounds fancy to me.
It really does, yeah.
A little bit about Olive that I thought was really interesting was that she was actually an active suffragette, and that she had actually spent a night in a cell after throwing a brick through a window.
Oh, Olive.
I don't know why she threw the brick in the window, but I'm sure it was for a good cause.
Yeah, they deserved it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I love that.
I know.
Sad about what's coming next.
Yeah, it's not going to go well for her, though.
Ah, fuck you, John. Why would you kill Olive?
I know. I love the name Olive as well. I don't know why. I just do.
Yeah, it's pretty, and they're really tasty as well.
No, they're really not.
Not the people. Not, I love Olive.
You wanted the sludge. You wanted her sludge.
John just keeps whispering in my ear. I don't know what he did with the sludge, but I'm just telling you, right? He's speaking through me now.
We should be concerned. So by this point, John had started going around calling himself an engineer and going on about his inventions and all this. So Olive had come to him because she had an idea herself about artificial fingernails. So I'm guessing this is like pre-fake nails, if she was coming up with it.
Yeah, Olive's like well ahead of her time.
Yeah,
she could have created a whole industry.
I know.
A nail technician in the making.
Exactly. Because it said on the thing that, like, as it was post-war, she felt that women needed a bit of, like, glamour, like something to make themselves feel nice. So she was, like, going, like, oh, yeah, we should get artificial fingernails. I was like, fuck yeah, Olive.
Aww.
I love Olive. So sad.
Ahead of her times in all the ways possible.
Yeah.
R.I.P. Olive. What a ledge.
I know. So Olive went to John and he was like, yeah, that's a great idea, Olive. Why don't you come down to my workshop?
See my research. See my research.
On the 18th of February 1949, he shot her in the back of the neck with the stolen gun, took all of her valuables, including a Persian lamb coat. She was a fancy lady.
She lost her love there a little bit, Olive. No.
Yeah, but it was the times.
You know? It was the times.
I think I can forgive her a little bit for that.
Yeah, she did a lot of cool things as well.
Yeah. So yeah, he did all that and then he put her in one of his acid baths. 2 days later, one of Olive's friends reported her missing. And funnily enough, it was actually John that took her friend to the police station to report her missing. So he was just like, oh yeah, I'll take you to the police station. And the back of his head, he's like, huh, 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 I know where she is.
She's in my barrel.
She's in my barrel.
That's so weird, isn't it? I always find it really fascinating when killers especially do that, where they try and act like they're going to help you try and solve the crime that they committed.
Yeah, I know. Mm. The thing is, though, it didn't really work out well for him, though.
Oh, okay. That's good.
Yeah, because one of the sergeants that was there when they went in to report a missing became really suspicious of John. And they were like, he's acting a bit shady. Like, I don't know. Getting vibes. Bad vibes from him.
That's good. Someone had their coffee that morning at the police station.
Exactly. So they were like, oh, we're going to look into a bit of his background. And obviously they found his track record of, you know, fraud and theft. And they were like, a rich old lady goes missing. And she's like friends with a guy who's, you know, into stealing money.
Two and two.
So they were like, let's go check out your workshop.
Aha.
Aha.
Not my research.
They found his research. So once they were there, they found a dry cleaning receipt for Olive's Persian lamb coat. They found evidence of him having sold off Olive's jewellery, and they also found some papers that referred to the Hendersons and the McSwans. Mm. So he wasn't very good at getting rid of his evidence, obviously, because he basically just had everybody who he'd killed, all their stuff was there. He was just like, what? What do you want from me?
The thing is, Amy, when you're doing research, you don't get rid of your evidence.
Well, that's true. You got to keep it for a later date, you know?
So maybe that was his plan all along.
Yeah. Also, at this property, Sosley, his first murder he did at his home, so he just poured the sludge down a manhole or whatever it was. But for the rest of them, he did it at the workshop, and there was no, like, drain there or anything. So he was literally just pouring out outside of the building, like, in the backyard.
Oh,
like,
no.
Pile of sludge.
No.
So obviously they found all these, like, sludgy, nasty...
Sludge piles.
Sludge pile. So a pathologist went through all this sludge, and he found 28 pounds of human body fat, part of a human foot, some human gallstones, and part of a denture, which was later identified by Olive's dentist during the trial.
Oh.
So there was even just, like, bits left. Like, some of it wasn't even fully dissolved.
And he just threw it outside?
Yeah, just outside in a pile.
Don't you think if you were getting rid of a body and you poured your sludge out and then you saw some of this stuff, you'd be like, I didn't do a good job. I need to sort that out, not just leave it there.
It's fine. It's fine.
Yeah, that's all good. It's all good.
Yeah. So, as you can imagine, John was taken in for questioning.
Was he?
During his questioning, John actually asked a detective, tell me frankly, what are the chances of anybody being released from Broadmoor, which was like the mental prison, mental asylum prison one?
Yeah.
The detective was like, well, I can't really talk to you about this stuff. He was like, what are you even asking for?
A nice deal.
When John started talking about, like, why he did it, he said, if I told you, you would not believe me. It sounds too fantastic to believe.
Okay, John, tell us about your research, John.
So then he followed on by confessing that he killed Olive, he killed the McSwans and the Hendersons, and he also claimed to have killed three other people.
Ooh.
He said he killed a young man called Max, a girl from Eastbourne, and a woman from Hammersmith. But these claims have never been substantiated. They've never been able to prove it. So that we don't know if that's true or not.
Such a weird thing to confess to.
I know.
While you're potentially getting sentenced as well, if it's a lie. Why?
Yeah, so it makes you think, like, did he do it then? Else why would he say it? But I don't know.
Or did he just want to waste police time?
Yeah, possibly. Like, make them look into it.
Interesting.
Yeah. Some other information that he gave was, in the case of Olive's murder, he said that he even had time for a cup of tea and a fried egg on toast at the local cafe between shooting her and starting her acid bath.
Oh, clearly he felt quite practiced at this point and he wasn't worried.
Yeah, he was just too chilled then, wasn't he? He's just like, yeah, I'm a bit hungry, a bit peckish.
Yeah, this can wait.
Yeah. So then John tried to plead insanity, which is why they think he was asking about Broadmoor.
Yeah.
So he started claiming that his motive for the murders was for drinking his victim's blood.
Oh.
Yeah.
Did I call that as well?
I'm not sure. Probably.
I said something about him eating the sludge and liking olive.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Oh, John, get out of my head.
He said that he'd cut a nick in their necks and would fill a glass or two with their blood. He said he had dreams when he was a young boy that were dominated by blood. And then when he was involved in a car accident later on in life, he got some blood into his mouth and his dreams returned to him. And that's sort of like what set it off, is what he was saying.
So he's like vampiring.
Yeah. And this is an exact, well, I think it's an exact quote. It was in quotation marks. So I'm
sure someone said this.
Exact quote. So he said, I saw before me a forest of crucifixes which gradually turned into trees. At first there appeared to be a dew or rain dripping from the branches, but as I approached I realised it was blood. The whole forest began to writhe and the trees, dark and erect, to ooze blood. A man went from each tree catching the blood. When the cup was full, he approached me. Drink, he said, but I was unable to move.
Wow.
So that was his lovely description of his creepy dreams.
Seems very, very well written, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, ooh, I want to read this book, but also this is crazy.
Yeah. Many believed that all this was just a ploy to avoid the death penalty.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I was going to say. I was like, I don't know. He seems like he had too much that he thought through. He wasn't acting criminally insane during the times where he was committing those.
Yeah. And like the fact that he was, you know, had these money ploy background anyway, you know, fraud and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, you weren't doing that for people's blood, were you, mate? No, you're doing it for the monies.
He's a greedy boy.
Yeah. So in the end, only took a couple of minutes for the jury to throw out his insanity plea and to find him guilty. And he was sentenced to death.
Like, it's a good thing because he clearly did it. But like, man, like, how did they get to that conclusion so damn quickly back then? I think I said this last season. Like,
I know.
It's mad. Surely you shouldn't be able to like decide whether someone lives or dies in minutes.
I know, it's mad, isn't it? So in the time between his like sentencing and his eventual death, he actually had his barber come in and out of prison, like do his hair and all that. And then the day before his execution, he had Madame Tussauds come to his cell and took a life mask for a wax model.
Yeah, the wax museums.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that happened on the day before he was going to get executed.
And they put him in the museum then?
Yeah, apparently he's in the museum. And he even donated his clothes to it.
Oh my God.
He was pretty happy to be a wax model.
Oh, that feels a bit icky. Like, you're giving him so much status.
I know, yeah. And the fact that he was obviously into it, like he wanted it to happen, makes it worse.
Yeah. Weird.
Yeah.
I know we do a podcast about murder, but it still feels icky.
Still, we didn't, you know, go to him and actually be like, do you want to be on our podcast? Like, yeah. This is them actually being like, oh, we want to make a wax model of you as a murderer.
That's true. As far as I'm aware, neither you nor me have gotten any wax templates of murderers made before. I think, Amy.
Not that I know of.
No? Okay, that's good. There we go. I can say with confidence.
No, just mice.
Oh, what? Oh, we got to talk about this. I'm going to get you some therapy.
I think you need it.
Oh, yeah. I think we both need it.
Some of the things you've been saying today.
We do a murder podcast.
So, we'll finally wrap up this story. On the 10th of August, 1949, John had a brandy and then was hung. And that is the end of John.
Wow.
And that was the story. That was my story.
I really enjoyed learning about your research, John's research.
Everyone's research.
Another British serial killer to store in the mind,
yeah.
Somewhere in the mind palace.
In the mind palace. Hopefully that didn't traumatise too many people.
Yeah, I think that was quite tame compared to some of your other stories.
I mean, more about like what we were saying.
Oh.
Traumatised by us.
I think we were pretty tame. No, probably. Yeah, disclaimer. We're very sorry. You should get therapy too, guys, on that topic. We spoke about us.
We'll all go together.
Yeah, let's hold hands and go. Sound. Amazing. So, shall we do some burning questions?
Yes, let's get to it. I will ask you yours first.
Okay.
I'm sure people are fed up of hearing my voice for one day so far.
No, never. Never. Never.
So, my question for you is, how often do people who serve time in prison for lesser crimes then go on to commit more serious crimes later on? Like our good old John.
Yes, John is a classic example.
Yes.
So, what we're talking about here is something psychologists and those in the crime field call recidivism, which just means the outcome where a convicted criminal relapses and it results in them being rearrested, reconvicted, or re-imprisoned. And this is a big topic area when it comes to criminal psychology, because it nails in on whether or not our prison systems are having the intended result. If we think about the dream scenario of our system, right? It is that someone commits a crime, they serve their punishment, understand where they went wrong, and then they leave prison better off before they go back out into society as a fully fledged functioning member of society again. But is that the reality?
Nope.
Nope. There we go. That is the answer.
That is it.
Yeah. So to answer your question about the likelihood of offenders going on to commit more serious crimes, I'm going to focus on some of the stats from the UK system in particular, because of course, generalising across nations with different criminal systems will just get us all very confused. But it's probably worth mentioning that this is definitely a global issue with prison systems, and the data does say the same thing in most countries with like a similar system to the UK. So, it's worth knowing a few things about recidivism in the UK. Firstly, it's a long-term problem and a massive failing in our prison system, which is why in the last decade we've seen a lot of effort and attention placed on trying to combat the issue. Back in 2013 and 2014, the data showed us that 46% of adult prisoners reoffend within a year of release. And that number went up to 60% when looking at people who had been sentenced to serve less than a year.
Jeez, that's a lot of people.
Right? It's scary. Yeah, so of course this implies that people who commit less serious crimes, hence the shorter sentence, are the ones who will most likely go on to reoffend. And it's also worth mentioning that the data doesn't really tell us whether or not their next crime is more serious, just that the majority of short-term sentences result in another offence. Also an important statistic worth mentioning is that they found young offenders, so those aged between 10 to 17 years old, actually have a higher reoffending rate than adults. And this pattern is visible all the way through the system. So reoffending rates are substantially higher among younger adults in the system over older adults. So I think this highlights a really destructive cycle of crime that is difficult to get out of and gears young people up for repeated offences.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly, that dream scenario we were talking about of long-term sustainable change in people is not happening, especially if we are struggling to redeem children in the system. And of course, there are so many factors as to why this is happening, and we would be here all day if I go into them all now. But it's things like how prisons can be a recruitment centre for criminal organisations, the availability of drugs inside, and of course the fact that restarting your life outside of prison, once you have a record, creates numerous hurdles. And so a life of crime seems like the only open door.
Yeah, you find that I think a lot of people say that when they've been in prison, it's like almost harder getting out and trying to be like normal when you get back out again. So you can see why they go back into their old ways, because it's like, oh, well, people see me that way anyway, might as well just do it.
Yeah, and like getting a job is harder, getting a home is harder, getting credit cards.
Yeah.
So it's very hard to actually reestablish yourself as a functioning member of society when everything's geared up to stop you from doing that.
Yeah.
Also, people who commit crimes like to return to the safety net of prison sometimes, because at least you have food, shelter and your friends together, and a space that is hidden from the rest of us who shun prisoners, like we were talking about.
Yeah.
So ultimately, if we don't set up a space in the outside world that facilitates further rehabilitation, then we can't really be that shocked as to why prisons pull people back in. So because of all these issues surrounding reoffending, the government introduced the Offender Rehabilitation Act back in 2014. The overview of this act is that nearly all offenders will receive at least 12 months supervision in the community once they are released, with the hopes of integrating them back in successfully. And it also includes an increased amount of drug testing required after someone is released.
I can't believe that only came in 2014.
Yeah. Right?
Like, you'd think that should have been something that was already a thing.
Yeah. Nope. It is definitely not.
That is mad.
Mm-hmm. The Justice Secretary at the time, Chris Grayling, commented on the act, stating, "A staggering 85,000 crimes are committed every year by prisoners released from short sentences. This legislation means those offenders will now get the support they need to turn their lives around and start contributing to society rather than damaging it." And, you know, it was good intentions and all that, and still might be.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is the data after the Offender Rehabilitation Act came into play actually saw a marked annual increase in the number of serious further offence convictions from 2014 to 2017, meaning more previously convicted prisoners were going on to commit more serious offences.
Oh, God. Okay. Didn't quite work then.
Oops. Yeah. Of course, you might be thinking, yep, hey, wait a minute, that's not the goal of this act. Surely there should be less serious offences now. But that's the thing, isn't it? Once the act was introduced, what happened is we just began to more closely watch for recidivism. And of course, we found it. So the new data just tells us that all those alarming rates prior to the introduction of the Rehabilitation Act were probably much higher.
Okay, yeah.
And we just didn't have the resources and the system in place to spot them. And now we do.
We just didn't know they were doing it.
Yeah. And obviously it was high enough for us to think that we needed an act in place.
Yeah.
So you think about how high it must have been to even get that attention and still be...
And then actually being like, oh, actually it's even worse, which probably means it was way worse before.
Yeah. It's very interesting, I think. I like this topic a lot.
Yeah, it is.
So the 2016 to 2017 data shows us through the annual convictions figures that they have stayed at quite a similar level, which is due to the fact that all those serious further offences identified by the new Offender Rehabilitation Act have started to stabilise. So it's currently not good numbers, but it's also not getting worse overall. So it's not that initial spike anymore.
Yeah, it's better than increasing.
Yeah. However, saying that, every year since 2015, the serious further offences relating to murder convictions have increased annually, which falls in line with the overall increase of murder convictions for both past offenders and first-time offenders. So that's worrying.
Yeah, I'm not scared at all. I'm never leaving my house again.
On a positive note, the number of serious further offence convictions relating to rape and other associated offences have seen a noticeable decrease year on year, which again follows the pattern of the general decrease in rape-related convictions for first-time and reoccurring offenders. So, more murder, less rape. Take with that what you will.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what else to say on that, to be honest.
It is what it is, I think.
Yeah. Of course, bear in mind that COVID could be impacting this data at the moment because, of course, there have been court delays and all that jazz. So really, until we see the data probably in the next few years, it's hard to say whether the Offender Rehabilitation Act is actually helping to stop reoffending from happening. All it has done so far is help keep us in the loop with ex-convicts and make it easier to spot when they are doing something criminal again. So, to summarise, all we know for certain when evaluating this available data is that reoffending accounts for a hefty whack of the crimes we experience in society, and short prison sentences do not deter people from committing more serious crimes. In fact, they become more likely. So really, if we want to prevent recidivism from happening, we need to try a new approach, perhaps one that actually removes the hurdles I spoke about and works with them on an educational and psychological front to see if long-term changes can be achieved.
Yeah.
And that's my answer.
That was a good answer.
So I thought I'd go for data today.
Yeah. That is pretty crazy.
Yeah, I thought so. I really find it shocking how likely children in that 10 to 17 age bracket are to reoffend.
Yeah, but I suppose it's, you know, if you're committing crimes at that age, normally there's like more to it, like more of a background of your environment has led to those things happening anyway.
Absolutely.
You're going to more likely do it again, I suppose.
Yeah, and also it just shows that sentencing them to juvenile facilities or, you know, prison down the line, like, you're not really combating the issue, are you?
Yeah, they're not doing much to help them, I think, yeah.
Because if they're that likely to reoffend, then clearly our juvenile system is shit.
Yeah, it's not doing too good.
Yeah, but then you've got to factor in gangs and, like I said, how they spread and how they recruit. And
yeah.
Oh, it's a big topic, guys.
It is.
We could be here all day just talking about it, but I thought it was very interesting.
But no, that was a good like snapshot of it. Yeah.
Yes. Don't commit crimes because you'll commit more crimes.
It's a never-ending cycle.
It's an addiction. No. You can stop people. Everyone can stop.
Exactly.
They just need support. That was my point overall, by the way. Not that everyone who commits crime is doomed to be a criminal forever. I hope that came across.
Yeah. That was totally what happened.
Yeah. So, Amy, it is your turn. It's your turn.
Me? Okay, I think I'm ready.
So before I ask this question, I just think it's worth mentioning that you shunned yourself away from answering a question about acid baths and how they work.
Yeah.
So guys, if you wanted all that gruesome detail, Amy's to blame for withholding it.
Right, let me just explain myself. Right. So originally, yeah. It was originally going to be a question on about, like, how to, like, dissolve a body in acid. And so, for one, I thought, that's probably not a great thing to be explaining how to do anyway and how it works. We already promote enough bad things on here anyway.
I draw the line at acid baths.
Do you? And when I started Googling it, I felt like a criminal. Like...
Yeah, I can get that. I can get behind
that. I'm definitely on a watch list now. I'm not even kidding. Like, typing into Google, how do you dissolve a body in acid? Or how long does it take? Or how does it work? And I was like, oh my god, I'm on a watch list, and I just couldn't do it.
Yeah. Imagine when they start accessing your phone and seeing those folders of dead mice.
Oh my god, they're going to think I'm a loon.
Yeah, this might be the last episode Amy does before she goes to prison, and she won't get out, as we've just discussed. She'll be reoffending, so this is it for Amy.
Honestly. And I would just like to say sorry to Izzy, because I know that she loves a gruesome. I know she loves the gruesome, so yeah. She would have loved to know.
You have to bring it to her. I won't do it.
I will. Yeah, I'm so sorry, but we're not going down that road today.
No, today we're doing something else. Just as interesting, just as exciting, just less gruesome.
Oh, we hope so.
So Amy's question today is, who was Georges Alexandre Sarret that influenced John's methods? The guy you mentioned earlier.
Yeah. So the guy who sort of, you know, influenced John's methods of disposal of the body, I thought, you know, let's get into a little bit of who he is.
A little mini serial killer story.
A little mini story.
Yeah.
So, Georges Alexandre Sarret was born on the 23rd of September 1878 in Trieste, Italy. He then emigrated to France during his childhood. He eventually went to university at University of Marseille.
That sounds right.
Yeah, we're going with it. Sorry, French people. So he went to the University of Marseille to study medicine, chemistry and law. So when he finished with his education, he became a lawyer. But on the side, he decided, I'm going to be a criminal.
Classic.
And his little bit of a crime spree was by setting up life insurance scams. So he got his two German lovers, who were actually sisters, Catherine and Philomene Schmidt, to marry to very old, unhealthy men. So you can kind of see where he was going with that, you know?
Pimping.
Yeah. And they thought, you know what? We'll help these old, unhealthy men to their death, but give them a bit of poison. And then when they die, we'll get their life insurance. Apparently, it was said that he managed to keep his two lovers in on this by threatening to take them to police and say that they were war criminals.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I was trying to find out why, like, were they? But I don't know. But there must have been something in their background that was a bit dodgy.
They were shady. There's some shadiness.
And he was like, if you don't help me, I'm going to take you to the police.
You're going down.
So they were like, okay, we'll help you with your scheme. And there was actually also another guy involved in this scheme. His name was Louis Chambon de Verger, who apparently was an unfrocked priest.
What?
You know, like when they get it taken off them.
Oh, yeah.
Not that he was naked.
I was so concerned then. I was like, oh, that's a weird detail, but okay.
He's just no longer a priest.
He just doesn't wear clothes anymore. That's his thing. He's my unfrocked buddy.
Just my unfrocked friend. So he got involved as well, and he would act as the unhealthy husbands for their medical exams. So obviously, if the actual old people went to get a medical exam for life insurance, they probably wouldn't get much, because they'd be like, well, you're kind of on your deathbed, so we know you're gonna die soon.
Yeah.
So he would go in for them, pretend to be them, and they'd be like, oh, okay, you're quite healthy, so you know, it'd be a good life insurance. So I was like, that's pretty smart.
It is.
So there was a whole little gang of them. But after some time, Sorette decided that Louis was becoming too greedy, and he started to worry that he was going to, like, dob them in, and he was a bit like, oh, I don't know about this guy. So in 1952, he decided he wanted to murder Louis. And whilst doing that, he thought, might as well take out his mistress as well.
Oh, okay. Damn.
Yeah. What he did is he murdered Louis and his mistress, and then he disposed of their body by putting them in the sulfuric acid in two bathtubs. So that was where John got his idea from.
Yeah.
But to be fair, you can kind of see why it became like a good idea for him, because this crime then went unsolved for 6 years.
Mm.
And it's only really by chance and not by Sorette's own fault that he got found out. So 6 years later, he hasn't been caught out by it. But his one lover, Catherine, was arrested for a different insurance scheme where she faked her own death by obtaining the body of a woman who was the same age as her and had her general description, and that she had died of tuberculosis. So she just used that body to pretend that she died. But she carried on going about her life, and she actually ended up going back to places where she used to live, and people were like, oh, you're alive. Yeah.
Did we not do this in the last season? Did we not say? If only they were alive to listen to our episodes before they did all this.
Honestly. So she was just like chilling, like back in her hometowns and stuff, and they were like, aren't you supposed to be dead?
Yeah.
So she obviously got caught out and got arrested. When they took her in for questioning, like, they started asking her all about these, like, insurance fraud and all this, and she ended up telling them everything, including Sorette's murder of Louis and his mistress. So, like, she was just dobbing them all in at this point. She was just like, oh, yeah, we've all done this.
Yeah, if I'm going down, you're coming too.
Yeah, exactly.
Honestly, I'd do the same to you, Amy.
Oh, I see how it is.
Oh, that is how it is.
I'm not involving you in my future cramps.
I need a prison buddy.
Oh, that's true.
I'm not going alone.
Okay, I'll do it for that.
Yeah, thank you.
That's all right. So, obviously, Sorette then got took in, but he managed to get his trial delayed for 2 years, but he was eventually found guilty in October 1933 and was sentenced to death. And he was then guillotined a few months later.
Oh,
yeah.
That sounds painful.
I know. And his two lovers, the Schmidt sisters, they only received 10 years in prison for their parts. Because I suppose they didn't actually kill anyone, did they? They were just involved in insurance schemes.
True.
And one more interesting fact I found was that the police actually found a great mass of bones in the garden of Sorette's house, which included an assortment of rat, cat and dog bones.
Aww.
And they believe that all those remains were actually created by him practicing dissolving things in acid. So similarly, John, you know, they both wanted to do a little bit of experimentation before. But yeah, that was the story of the influence.
Look at that. Two for one today.
Yeah, there you go, guys. Treating you.
Yeah. Aren't we the best?
Honestly.
Isn't Amy the best?
Oh, I know.
Right, so it's time to wrap up the episode, Amy, with the hardest part of the whole thing.
It's always the hardest part.
The nice note. It's so hard. Do you have one? Do you have a nice note?
I never have a nice note. We know this by now.
Last season it was me. This season it's you.
Oh, I know what mine would be.
Yes.
I had a really nice cocktail the other day that I'd never tried before.
Ooh, what was it?
Is that what I sent a picture of to our little group?
Yes, the many drunken Amy snaps.
Yeah. Gotta be done.
I didn't think you were gonna make it home.
I was actually surprisingly all right compared to everyone else.
Didn't you have to get 25 drinks before you the end of the night?
Yeah, I didn't make it. I didn't make it to that. There was no way.
You send the picture at like drink 10 and I was like, oh, she looked like she's about to pass out.
Like, to be fair though, like most of those drinks were just like shots of sours and I don't count that as alcohol. That's not real. Not a real drink. But yeah, this cocktail I had was called a Rhinestone Cowgirl, and it had pink gin, tequila, blackcurrant lime, cranberry juice, and lemonade, and it was so good.
That does sound really nice.
Honestly, delicious.
Oh.
So everyone needs to have that cocktail in their life.
That's a great recommendation.
That is my nice note.
Nice note. I want to make that.
It does sound good though, doesn't it?
I wonder if it's as good as you remember when you drink it, not drunk.
That's true. This was my last drink, so who knows?
Yeah, you have to do the taste test when you're sober to see if it's really as good as you remember.
Yeah, see if it's nice.
Yeah.
What's your nice note?
My nice note is I have a potential completion date for the house next month.
Ooh!
Yeah.
That is a nice note.
Yeah, it's all progressing forward. Been a bit of a nice week for it because the house went to probate.
Yeah.
And then I thought, oh my God, there's going to be a big delay because obviously COVID and all the legal side of it. But no, I got told this week that it's gone through probate and we're talking completion days now. And yeah, so hopefully July we'll be in our new place.
That's so exciting. And then house party.
House party when we're all allowed.
True that. Yeah, hopefully. Fingers crossed. That's so good. That is a nice note.
It's exciting. It's kind of like a process of waiting the whole time. And then now I'm like, oh my God, I can kind of picture it.
Yeah. Such an adult.
You're such an adult. It's scary. It's all scary.
I love how your nice note was like proper like adult, like, oh yeah, getting a house. And mine was just like, I had a real good cocktail.
Yeah, but each is a success, Amy, because that cocktail sounds amazing.
This is true.
And... You know, I'm actually more jealous that I didn't go and get a nice cocktail on my birthday. I had a couple of beers.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to make that cocktail whenever you have the house and then...
When we have the house party. Yeah, see?
Yeah.
It all ties in.
Sounds like a great idea.
See how they both come together in perfect harmony.
It's beautiful.
And that is the real nice note.
That is.
Harmony. Amazing. So, next week is episode 5. Oh my God, halfway through already.
Halfway through.
Madness. Mad. And it is my turn.
It is.
And my guide, my word of the episode is political crime.
Ooh.
You have to come back where we get all political.
Spooky.
I don't want to tell you anymore.
Yes. Keep the suspense.
Have a killer week, of course.
Of always.
And goodbye.